resistance is useless. Come and join us as we take a trip back to 2001 as the Doctor and Charlie encounter the Cybermen.
This is better than I'd hoped for. Can't see any damage. I bet the weapon systems are in perfect condition. Those squaddies in the ride will give anything for high-class equipment. We are going to make a killing.
Doctor! Doctor! Where are you? Gone again.
No luck, then. I thought for a moment you were going to cry out for help.
Oh, how can you be so annoying?
Anyone hear that?
Negative. What have you got, Kelsey?
Something that sounds not nice.
What's that?
What?
Stay where you are, Doctor.
You saw something?
Yes. Yes, something moving on the deck. Over there.
Doctor?
It's gone now.
Why has my revival been delayed?
So welcome back to Cloister Bell, a podcast brought to your ears by the generous support of the fabulous patrons. A podcast which discusses a story from Doctor Who, and if we can both agree that it was a good story, the Cloister Bell will toll. So will the bell ring today? That's the question. I'm Rob, and I'm here with Liam.
Hi, Rob. Hi, everyone.
Hello. Back again. It's probably a year and a half or a year since we did Storm Warning.
Yeah, it's been quite a while. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. We're a bit useless, aren't we? So, yes, we are revisiting today the second of the Eighth Doctor audio adventures from Big Finish Productions. It's a Cyberman story featuring the Doctor and Charlie. It's called The Sword of Orion. Never mind that, though. How are you, Liam?
Yeah, I'm very well, thanks. Can't complain. It's been a very quick week. How about you?
Oh, yeah, these weeks are flying by. Especially with doing like family stuff, seeing parents and other things. The weeks are just flying by really quick, too fast. So it doesn't leave much time. But yeah, I had time to listen to Sword of Orion. And I listened to it a few months ago, in fact, in preparation for this, but I needed a refresher. Was it your first listen? Just curious.
Yes. Yeah, yeah.
But you'd maybe bought it a long time ago, yeah?
Yeah. Big Finish do these sales on occasion, and it was one of those where they were selling them, basically, all these digital downloads for peanuts. So I bought a whole load of Big Finish. I listened to some, but not all. So I can't for the life of me remember when I bought it, but it was a long time ago. Finally, thanks to this podcast, got around to listening to it. So it wasn't money wasted.
That's good. I've got the CD here, which I got a long time ago. And it's got the kind of inverted colour of the logo, the bronze. Nice little cover. Yeah. I've also got my Eighth Doctor movie edition figure here with me today.
Nice.
And I've got my nice master mug with Eric Roberts' master face and me today because we're doing an Eighth Doctor story. And I'm just going to fill it with Budweiser. So if I can find a bottle opener here somewhere. Yeah, I was going to have a cup there, but I just thought I'd just have some beer.
Fair enough.
What's the Eighth Doctor's drink of choice?
Tea.
Yes. Yeah. So, no other things to catch up on, I don't think?
No, not really. Just as long as we're both doing well, I think that's the main thing.
Yeah. I haven't been watching much. I've been watching Gladiators with the kids.
Oh, right, okay. I saw the trailer for that. I knew that they were bringing it back. My reaction was, oh, for God's sake, really?
It's actually a lot of fun.
Is it also very nostalgic?
It is. Sky did a reboot of it, I don't know, 10 or 20 years ago, which didn't have the nostalgia. But this one really does. It's got all the aesthetics, all the wrestling pantomime kind of vibes to it.
Is it very 90s?
Yes, 90s, but also edgy and modern. It's like the kids are really engaging with it. They're like, what is this? This is so good. And it's quite interesting following the competitors, and they get to the Eliminator, which is the final kind of assault course they need to go through, which is exactly the same as the olden days. So yeah, it's actually a lot of fun. Yeah.
Oh, okay, well, glad you're enjoying it.
And I watched some show, it was the TikTok Murder something. It's a documentary series about like murders through TikTok relationships. And there was this mother-daughter who kind of derailed this car and killed these two guys.
Jeez, okay. Well,
yeah, this has took a dark turn, sorry. Onto some lighter stuff. I guess we'll get on with the show. Yeah. Anything to mention before we do that? Quick plug for the website. Yeah, you just make cloisterbellpodcast.com part of your daily routine. Go there, check it out. We have a forum and all of our old podcasts there. Do you go there daily, Liam? Just say yes.
Yes, I do, yeah.
That's good. So, on with the story. So, the plot for Sword of Orion. I'm wondering if the one I've got off the TARDIS wiki is the same of my CD case. The human race is locked. Oh, yeah, it's the same as my CD case. I'll just read from there. So, the human race is locked in a deadly combat with the android hordes in the Orion system. Light years from the front line, the Doctor and Charlie arrive to sample the dubious delights of the galactic backwater, little suspecting that the consequences of the Orion War might reach them out there. But High Command's lust for victory knows no bounds. Trapped aboard a mysterious derelict Star Destroyer, the Doctor and Charlie find themselves facing execution, but this is only the beginning of their troubles. The real danger has yet to awaken. Until somewhere in the dark recesses of the Garrison system, the Cybermen receive the signal for reactivation. Do you think this would have worked better as like a surprise return for the Cybermen?
Yes, I think so, because they do the structure where really they don't appear until, is it the cliffhanger to episode one, or do they not appear until episode two? I can't quite remember.
We'll have
now
to go through our notes today and we'll figure out which episode it is. But even when you see the Cybermat in episode one, it's not clear what that is.
No, I mean, I think if you're knowledgeable about Doctor Who and know that this is a Cyberman story, I think it's like, oh, it's clearly a Cybermat. But if they had they not mentioned that in the blurb, or had the Cybermen on the CD cover and held off on that, yeah, you could easily just listen to the story going, what is this? And then when it's revealed to be a Cybermat and the Cybermen involved, that could have been a big surprise.
Yeah.
But I think with something like this, it's you're waiting for the Cybermen to turn up. So I think it would have been quite nice if it had been a surprise. But never mind.
Never mind. This was an existing story anyway. There was a series called Audio Visuals that came out in the mid to late 90s. I'm sure someone will correct me. And Nick Briggs played the Doctor in that, I believe. So you can listen to the whole thing. I think it's out there on YouTube. I put a link to that video in our forum if anyone wants to check that out. But it was the original fan-produced drama, audio drama of The Sword of Orion. And I think it translated pretty similar to this. It's been years since I listened to that version. Is that something you were aware of?
I was aware of it. I haven't listened to it. Mm. But yeah, I was aware that it had been this pre-existing thing.
Yeah.
Who wrote it though? Was it Garrett? Was it oh, I've forgotten the chap's name now, who I'm thinking of. Or was it Nicholas Briggs? Gary Russell is who I'm thinking of. Did Gary Russell write it?
No, written and directed by Nick Briggs.
Oh, right, okay.
There is a caption inside the CD, if you want me to read that.
Yeah, yeah.
Although for some strange reason, the tried and trusted formula of a Doctor Who story seems as familiar as a well-loved old friend to me. And Sword of Orion itself is an adventure from a precious existence of mine. This story was a grand opportunity to, for a reinvention and reimagining. Producers Gary and Jason had often spoken to me of their wish to bring back Sword of Orion as a crackling, hissing, amateur analog audio adventure buried back in the 1980s. Oh, so it wasn't the 90s. It had been flatteringly popular, but surely it wouldn't simply be a case of transcribing the original cassette and handing the result to Paul McGann, would it? I have to admit that a surprisingly large amount of the original, feverently typed with two sore fingers on an Olivetti portable typewriter, does survive.
Have you lost the ability to read, Rob?
Yes, yeah, completely. Oh. Sorry, I'm struggling to read this. The lights are off in the room I'm in.
All right, okay, fair enough.
Where was I?
Typing with fervently with two fingers. Fingers or something like that.
Oh, yes. However, the reinvention centres around the new Doctor himself, not just because Paul's interpretation of the character has its own unique flavour, but because the only on-screen template for these new adventures was distinctly cinematic in nature. So in a way, I set out to write an audio movie. Certainly in the opening episode, I wanted there to be the feeling that this could have been the next Doctor Who movie to be made. Just a little bit of indulgence on my part. But my aim was to stitch this claustrophobic cyber encounter into a broader futuristic tapestry. As for directing the new Doctor himself, my chief memory is of Paul's sense of fun and the slightly suspicious look he used to give me when I said, "Give me more foreboding." Mind you, I have no idea of the expression on his face when I was directing him from a soundproofed booth with my voice cyber-distorted. How could the Doctor be expected to take direction from the cyber leader himself? Somehow Paul managed it with consummate ease. So that was there, Nick Briggs in 2000. Yeah, so I guess it was adapted differently for this version.
Yeah, but by the sounds of it, in terms of the script, not much. And from what I can gather, what Nick Briggs has said is that really what makes it different to his recording of it back in the 80s is obviously Paul McGann as the Doctor adding his own interpretation of it.
Well, we'll have a look at the cast and crew. Of course, the Doctor was Paul McGann, Charlie Pollard, India Fisher. This is her second story. Grash was Bruce Montague, Diva Jensen, Michelle Livingston. Chev was Helen Goldwyn. She'd played a Triskele in Storm Warning. Ike was Ian Maher. Vol was Hilton Collins. He'd played Chief Steward Weeks in Storm Warning. Do you remember him?
Vaguely. I mean, it's been quite a while since I've listened to Storm Warning. Yeah.
Kelsey was Toby Longworth. Digley, Barnaby Edwards. Thinnies was Mark Gatiss. Cyberleader/Cybermen was Nicholas Briggs. And additional Cybermen voices, Alistair Locke. Those two of those later roles, Barnaby Edwards and Mark Gatiss, was of the initial scene aboard the Silver Jackal. A illustrated preview featured in Doctor Who magazine 301. WhatsApped that to you today, Liam. Mm-hmm. I've also posted it on the socials if anyone wants to see that. That was by Lee Sullivan. I think he did the one for Storm Warning as well. I'll pop that on the website as well. So, yeah, so should we go for a full breakdown of each story? See if we can keep this under an hour?
We can try, yep.
Just have a bit of bud. So, part one of four. So this story takes place, of course, after the TV movie and after the previous Big Finish story, Storm Warning, in which the Doctor met his new companion, Charlie. I would say you can check this story out as a standalone, wouldn't you say?
Yes, I mean, it clearly follows on from Storm Warning, and there are some references to that previous story, but they're not done in a way where you'll be completely lost. It's only just a few moments here and there, and they're clearly explained. So,
and they've clearly got some kind of creature, a Vortisaur, aboard the TARDIS, which mm-hmm. is the bit of continuity from the previous story, because they flew off into the horizon on Ramsay the Vortisaur, and he's kind of stayed. Charlie, though, in this story, she kind of comes across as a little bit of a seasoned traveler with the Doctor. Like, she seems accustomed to kind of what he does and all these new cultures a little bit. Mm-hmm. Not that it comes across in the dialogue, but more like her kind of demeanor and the way she reacts to things. It's like, this doesn't necessarily need to be our first adventure in the TARDIS, does it?
No, that's true.
Mm. I don't know what else you could squeeze in here. I know the light at the end was ambiguously placed somewhere in this first season. So, I mean, that could come before this. So the Doctor and Charlie are in the TARDIS tending to the Vortisaur, Ramsay, because he's looking a bit under the weather. And they want him to perk up a bit before they let him set him loose back into the vortex to fly free. Then we get a ship called the Silver Jackal, which is out doing some illegal scavenging. We have Captain Thinnes, which is Mark Gatiss, and Diggley is Barnaby Edwards, and they're the crew. But they're also part of Grash's scavenging group. Grash will be a character that we'll be talking about later on. He's part of the Vanguard's crew. But he kind of seems like a bit of a ringleader in the scavenging group, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does.
So the Silver Jackal finds an abandoned Star Destroyer. Just two guys think they can take on that find. But they get killed. They get clobbered to death. Good opening. That's like a pre-title opening, isn't it?
Yeah. I think it was very good. It certainly grabbed my attention, and I was looking forward to listening to the rest of the adventure. So yeah.
And then we are taken to the Garrison system. So the Doctor and Charlie are visiting the Garrison Bazaar. And I think this is good, because it's not one of those stories where it just takes place on a spaceship. You can hear the culture. They're out and about. So this first episode's quite got a lot of stuff. Locations, high speed chases, lots of stuff going on. So initially they're looking for something to help Ramsay, the Vortisaur. So they end up in a shop, and the shopkeeper, Ike, is moonlighting as a trader / smuggler. And the Doctor spotted him earlier on down by the ship dock.
Better than Aladdin's cave, isn't it?
A lot of tinsel and bric-a-brac, more like. But you never know, might be hidden treasure somewhere.
Head plug's less than half price, Dolly.
Head
Thank you, but mine's not leaking.
Huh?
Doctor, what on earth is a head plug?
Nothing on earth. Hello, doing a spot of moonlighting, are we?
What do you mean?
My friend and I parked our ship at the space dock. I'm sure I saw you leaving the main gate earlier on.
No, it weren't me.
Oh, I know you've been careful enough to unclip your insignia, but the shirt is standard issue. Nobody else makes them quite like the Merchant Space Corps, do they?
Yeah, well, look, I'm about to shut up shop, so if you don't mind...
Ship leaving today, is it?
So, Ike's a bit cautious here, because he thinks he's the Doctor might be some kind of an official. So, Ike calls his crew, what he calls Grash. Tells him about the Doctor and Charlie stooping around. And Grash has got bigger news because their ship, the Vanguard, they've had a last-minute change of captain. And they're about to depart as well. So it's kind of all go at this point. So the Doctor and Charlie are concerned about the TARDIS because they'd mentioned it and they're worried this Ike will... run off to take it, so they get a grav pad and kind of head off to the space dock. This kind of reminiscent of like going through San Francisco on a motorbike. How did you visualize the grav pads?
Not like a motorbike. I thought it was sort of like I visualized it.
It's like a platform.
Yeah, more of a platform with a sort of like a domed force field.
Yeah, I didn't think they were on some kind of Harleys flying through the air. So what do you think of this Ike at this point in the story?
I liked the character. I liked the whole setup of where they were with in the bazaar. And you get a real sort of mental picture of different areas within this one location where you got, you know, the space dock and then you've got this sort of... bazaar with all these different markets selling pretty much anything that you would, you know, want for shady characters and so on. I liked his introduction and yeah, the fact that he's moonlighting and all the rest of it, and he's a bit concerned about the Doctor and Charlie.
Mm.
Yeah, I liked all that. I thought it was really good.
And Charlie got to interact with some of the people because when we first see Charlie at the bazaar, she's asking for stuff about Vortisaurs, and we've got this some kind of alien who is being a bit forward with her and then kind of puts his hands on her and he gets a bit of a slap. And she's thinking, where is the Doctor? But it turns out the Doctor was watching her the whole time. And he kind of says something like, I almost thought you were going to call out for help. But he didn't. He was kind of gauging how she was going to respond, and she can clearly take care of herself here.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So they're on these grav pads going back to the space dock and it just starts to break down, but they managed to kind of get there on time and they spot the TARDIS being loaded onto the ship. It's kind of mistaken as cargo, so yeah, the Doctor and Charlie kind of get on the Vanguard before it sets off. Have we had any other situations where the TARDIS has been kind of mistaken as cargo or something like that? I know it's been snagged a few times, maybe by UNIT. I don't know though.
It's got to have done. It seems like such an obvious thing to do, but I can't think. Apart from
Fires of Pompeii, it gets sold.
Oh yes, as a piece of art, yeah. Mm. So there is that. There's also the Matt Smith story, Journey to the Center of the TARDIS. It's been such a long time since I've seen that episode, but doesn't that begin with the TARDIS seen as scrap or something?
Oh right, okay. Oh. So they just kind of get on the Vanguard just in time. So the Vanguard depart, and to the crew's frustration, they're ordered by this new captain, Diva Jensen, to kind of go with some coordinates. But before long, the Vanguard cuts power to the hyperdrive because they have this proximity alert because they've arrived at the Star Destroyer. So Captain Jensen orders like this short hyperdrive burst to avoid collision. Mm-hmm. And that kind of jolts the TARDIS onto the Star Destroyer somehow, doesn't it?
Mm. Yeah, yeah.
So the Doctor and Charlie return to the TARDIS They see the Star Destroyer on the scanner, hyperdrive jumps, TARDIS jumps over at the other ship. But because of this, the TARDIS is kind of full of temporal energy, which is kind of good for the Vortizor.
Yeah.
But conveniently for the story, they have to leave the TARDIS for a while it kind of fixes itself.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, are there examples of this? Maybe like, Rise of Cybermen? They had to wait for the TARDIS to kind of recharge?
Yes, and also, recently in Wild Blue Yonder.
Oh, yeah.
Before the HADS comes on, they would have to have waited for the TARDIS to sort itself out after Donna spilled the coffee all over the console.
Yeah.
So there is that. And I actually think it's, with those examples, and including in Sword of Orion as well, I think that is, I didn't think it was stretching credulity or anything like that. I didn't roll my eyes while I listened to it. It seemed like a perfect in-universe reason of why they have to become separated from the TARDIS and get thrown into the adventure and not just, this is a bit difficult. Let's clear off. Mm-hmm.
It probably did Ramsay some good, so it kind of killed two birds with one stone in this plot. Yeah. So they exit the TARDIS and realise they're on the other ship, where they find huge chairs, huge doorways. This is clearly being used for some big people.
Mm-hmm.
Throughout this story, I feel like there was a lot of kind of alien nods here and there. More so in like the later episodes.
Oh yeah, it's smacked of alien. I mean, to be perfectly honest, to the point of... and don't get me wrong, I'm not knocking the story for this. I mean, if you're going to be influenced by something, be influenced by the best. And I love Alien. It's one of my all-time favourite films. I just think it's fantastic. And I know that you're a big fan of the series as well, Rob. And yeah, when I was listening to this...
It's a bit close.
I suppose so. Yeah, I mean, to be perfectly honest, when I was listening to this story, I did pretty much imagine that it was set in the Nostromo, to be honest. Not completely, but I mean... pretty darn close to it. So,
especially some of the twists with some of the characters and some of the locations. And yes, it even has this, like, elements of Blade Runner too.
Yes, it does actually. Now that you mention it, that didn't cross my mind. But yes, you're right, it does. But I think Alien is the much more obvious influence. But
we'll,
you're right.
We'll make sure to highlight all the Alien references that we can as we go on. So Grash and the crew... they're a bit defiant with this new Captain Diva Jensen, about boarding the other ship. But she persuades them with double bonuses in return. Now, that's a bit alien, isn't it? Yeah, what about the bonus situation?
Yes. Yeah.
Sorry, I didn't realise a reference was coming so soon in the conversation. So the Vanguard crew spacewalk over to the Star Destroyer, as the airlocks aren't compatible. And they split up to search the ship. One of the crew, Kelsey, comes across the TARDIS. Oh, they even have a motion tracker, don't they? Something's coming towards you. God. He's like, it's just a blue box. But no, a Cyberman emerges. We don't know this yet, but it clobbers him to death. And that's part one. So yeah, there was no direct references to Cybermen. Apart from maybe in the bazaar, the Doctor found a gold-plated Cyberman head. And that was quite reminiscent of like Van Staten's museum a little bit.
Yes, you're right. Yeah.
Although gold-plated, is that a bit like... would it have came gold-plated? Or has someone gold-plated it afterwards? Wouldn't have came gold-plated, because they wouldn't like that.
No, I thought it was probably something that, it was some sort of souvenir and they gold-plated it. Or may have even actually been a replica.
Maybe, yeah. So, part two, the Doctor and Charlie discover Mark Kelsey's body. Still has a faint pulse, so still alive. Although some of the descriptions here, like, are a bit conflicting. Like, when they're talking about Kelsey's body, he's like, what's left of it? yet he's still alive enough to get medical treatment, they think. Like, what visual state is body in? I'm not really sure. But yeah, Chev and Grash arrive on the scene and they find the body, assuming that the Doctor and Charlie are the killers. They've literally been caught red-handed. And so they're escorted back to the Vanguard to speak with Captain Jensen. This is where we kind of get a taste of Grash's stubbornness. We had it a little bit with D.Va Jensen earlier when he was refusing to go over to the other ship. Very stubborn and doesn't appreciate authority or perhaps women. It's like he's the boss there. I wonder what kind of relationship Grash had with the previous captain. Do you think they were kind of in cahoots about the smuggling?
Oh yeah, probably.
Or was the previous captain a bit of a pushover?
No, they're probably dead pally and on the same wavelength.
So the Doctor catches a glimpse of something when they're escorted back. We'd later learn that this is a Cybermat. But you see something moving across the floor and it's left scratch marks. So they follow it and it's burned through some power cables, except for the life support, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
And we learn it hitched a lift on the back of Grash's backpack. And all this time, Grash is still going on about how you can't trust these two people. You know, they were caught with a body. Let's just execute them on the spot. You know, Captain, you've got the authority. Let's just kill them. So the Doctor proposes diverting power from the life support to the other systems. So he goes off with this character of Vol. Vol is one of Ike's mates, who was fairly new. He's the one that's not in on the smuggling. So yeah, Vol's quite nice. So they're then able to detect a signal at the stern of the ship. So I guess the Cybermats moved and kind of broadcasting to the Cybermen. Jansen wants to go over to the derelict with the Doctor, but Grash doesn't like this idea, and then he kind of assumes command and relieves Jansen of her duty. Yeah, so we've got a bit of a mutiny going on. So Grash attempts to leave the area, but the engines aren't working because of sabotage from the Cybermat. So he agrees to let the Doctor and Jansen go to the Star Destroyer because he knows they'll die or they'll get left behind or whatever. And Ike tells Chev and Grash that it was the Doctor and Charlie that he'd met in the shop.
Mm-hmm.
In the bazaar. So, yeah, that must be pretty worrying for Ike. Grash tells Vol and Ike to repair the engines, and they're going to use Charlie as bait against the Cybermat. Jansen and the Doctor meet and kill a rogue Cyberman. This is aboard the Star Destroyer. And she just kills them with one shot. Like, her gun's designed for this. So he deduces that there's a Cybermat on the Vanguard, because if there's Cybermen here, that must be what's over there. And we hear the Cybermen planning to awaken their leader. What do you think of episode 2? There was a lot in there to unpack, really. We had people at the scene of a crime, accusations. We had a mutiny.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mystery with a Cybermat. Then we finally have the reveal of the Cybermen and the Cyber Leader. So, that was a good episode.
Yeah, I agree with that. And as you said, Rob, there was an awful lot going on, but I think it's paced very well. I mean, it's one of the things I would say about listening to The Sword of Orion is that being Big Finish and what they were about and so on, I think, you know, and the people involved in making these stories, they're clearly Doctor Who fans. And I was picking up on all these sort of references either within the dialogue or certain events that were taking place, or even with the sound effects, it's you get the continuity references. So when the Doctor is looking at the damage that the Cybermat has done, but the fact that he's left the life support system on, which is the yellow and black, I think that's the colours.
Yeah.
That was sort of like, oh, that's similar to the colours in the Ark in Space. Then you've got all the scratches that the Cybermat leaves, and that's something that was commented on in Revenge of the Cybermen. And I'm leaping ahead here. We'll talk about it later on. But the fact that the Cybermen are able to take control of the humans without converting them at that point is very much like the wheel in space. So you're getting all these references, but of course, but I think they're done in such a way where you don't have to be fully aware. You know, if you're aware of these stories, then you're going to pick up on them. But if you're not familiar with them, you're still able to follow the narrative. I think it's done very well. But one thing, I think the first episode really functioned. And I completely agree with what we're saying before, Rob, which is that you know, Charlie could have very easily been a bit of a seasoned companion at this point. There could have been adventures set between Storm Warning and this. But at the same time, I think the first episode is a means of obviously setting up the main characters of the story, but really as a means of giving Charlie something to do and have a bit of a variety and get all the things in motion for the main thrust of the story, which takes place in episodes 2, 3, and 4, where now that you're set on these two spacecraft, and really I think the story becomes an exercise in atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
I found that the story quite atmospheric, and you're on these, you know, these similar locations, and obviously the whole thing of Alien, as we said before, really starts to come to the forefront of this. I don't really regard this really as a Cyberman story, though, but perhaps we can talk about that later on. I mean, obviously they're there, but they're not really the main... I mean, it's great that that's the Cybermen, but you could have easily replaced them with something else, and it wouldn't have really affected the story. They could have easily been something else. So I don't really regard it as a Cyberman story. What I see this is a focus on character and atmosphere more than anything.
Oh, yeah. And utilising the Cybermen in this story, I think, works well in that final act, mm-hmm. where what they're an analogy of and what the final kind of moral of the story is as well, kind of worked well. On the front of the cover, we have an invasion head of the Cybermen. I think on the original AV version that came out on cassette, I think that might have been an Earthshock Cyberman on there as well. But I do like the aesthetic of the invasion.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure. I'm sure we've had this discussion years ago, what's our favourite looking one? And I'm always torn between Invasion and Earthshock looking ones. I definitely go Invasion over Revenge.
Yes, I agree with that. Although I know a lot of people seem to dump on the design in some respects for the ones in Revenge of the Cybermen. But I still think the ones in Revenge are still quite good. Maybe the fact that they have slightly flared trousers clearly dates it to 1974. And maybe that would tweak it. But in terms of the main body of the costume, the chest unit and the helmet, I think, you know, I like all that actually. I agree with you. I think that the invasion design is better than Revenge, but I still kind of like the design of Revenge.
Yeah. And the timeline of the Cyberman aesthetics never makes any sense, does it really? Because these guys are like post Telos, yet the invasion ones were in whenever it was, the 60s or 70s.
Oh, yeah, the unit dating controversy. I think it was supposed to take place in the early 70s, but...
But either way, that's, like, basically present day. Yet these guys are around in the far future. But the Cyberman aesthetics, it's not linear. It's just all over the place, because in the show, the looks get better, but the stories are set in different times. But we'll just forget about that.
Power is low. No response beyond phase one. Increase the power. Our leader must be revived.
So let's move on to part three. So in part three, two Cybermen are sent to the Vanguard while the other Cyberman remains to repair the systems above the Star Destroyer. So Vol and Ike send Charlie ahead so she can kind of make sure the Cybermat's not there, or if it is there, hopefully it'll just kill her. And if it doesn't kill her, Grash wants Ike to kill her. So he's not too sure about doing that. So the Cybermat does present itself, and Vol ends up shooting it to save Charlie. Do you think if it hadn't have came to that, what do you think Ike would have done? Still not killed her? Because he kind of had reservations about that.
Yeah, I mean, I think these other characters are more decent and questioning. Gash, no, not Gash. What's his name, sorry?
Gash. Grash.
Grash. I was almost there. Grash is very, very stubborn. He's clearly got anger management issues. And, you know, as soon as he has a thought in his head, it has to be acted on and think of the consequences later.
Yeah.
That in itself poses a, you know, a threat to the story. But it actually becomes a big moment. His whole way of being becomes a big moment in how he comes out of the story. So all that's utilized. But yeah, he's it's a bit of a knob, really. But
a bit.
Yeah.
So Jansen and the Doctor suspect an ion storm must have hit the cybership. That's why they're not very active, not many of them there, and why there has been rogue Cybermen kind of running around killing people. So they find hundreds of partly converted humans, which is quite a visual aspect to the story. They say, like, the organic components have kind of rotted away, while the cyber components still look like the new off the factory line.
Yeah.
And that's kind of some visuals we've had in modern Doctor Who, yeah? Kind of touched upon both early on in, like, Matt Smith era and then maybe a bit more in Jodie Whittaker's, possibly, I don't know.
Yeah, it's one of those things where Attack of the Cybermen, the Colin Baker story, sort of touches upon it. And definitely new Doctor Who has. From,
like, in the Pandorica opens, had like a skull inside the head. It was that weird rogue head, though, that was crawling around. But that was like
one of
those few moments where you're not just presented with the fact, oh, you know, there's a human brain in there. But it kind of, it's that visual body horror aspect that, you know, there is people in there. And I'm sure, was it in The Flux where they had to, like, rip the bodies out to get inside the cyber suits?
Oh, yes, I forgot about that. Yeah.
That wasn't on screen, obviously, but that was a very graphic kind of image, yeah.
Yeah, it's one, so... it's good when I think the show sort of dabbles in that, because it's looking at what the Cybermen really are, in a way which, but the thing is, The TV series obviously can only go so far. Whereas I think that the Cybermen work much better in this sense in novelizations and in the Big Finish audio, because you can describe these sort of things and be really sort of graphic and horrific about it, which the TV series can't.
Oh, let's not forget Bill.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was pretty horrific.
Yeah, very much so. Yeah.
So, looking at these, Captain Diva Jansen is quite curious about how the process worked. So, this is an early hint of something she's intrigued by. Mm. Something that would be revealed later on. So, on board the Vanguard, the two Cybermen enter via the airlock. Chev opens fires with no effect and manages to escape. And then that twat Grash is, it sounds like he's rendered unconscious. Or killed, but that's not the case just yet. So the cyber leader is revived from hibernation. We had a whole sound effect sequence of him, I don't know, ripping out of a carrier bag or whatever there is. and he orders the conversion of the Vanguard crew. He's pretty pissed. Like, why was my revival delayed? And that's actually a sequence that was in the comic strip thing. What did you think of that?
Yeah, I mean, I really liked it. It harkens back to the invasion, the Patrick Troughton story, but there's an added element to it in the visual, which I think is very effective. I do like it. It's a very strong image. I'm not too sure about the picture of Paul McGann's doctor, though.
Yeah. And then that person next to him will be Diva Jansen.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. With her purple hair.
Yeah, I didn't realise it was purple in my imagination.
But it's funny, it's sort of like a contrast, because if you look at the Cybermen immediately above, there's a hint of purple in it.
Oh, is there? And he's got, in his little ear strut things, isn't there like fluid running through them?
Yes. Yeah.
That's a new thing, yeah? That's not something we've seen. I mean, with things like this, it would have been good if we got more visuals, because, you know, when you have like an audio drama or you're reading a book, and sometimes, well, I don't know, for me, sometimes I'll keep going back to the cover and kind of, it's my one... tangible visual thing that I can kind of work my imagination around. And so, you know, sometimes you get book covers and just utter crap. And sometimes you get some really good book covers with good illustrations. So it's good that these stories had that extra thing to kind of latch on to help your imagination. But then in that regard, like, it was just kind of rehashing some scenes from this story. Scenes that we could easily visualize. Apart from the purple hair or whatever a haircut is.
Yeah.
That came as a shock.
But the fact that that they add their tweaks to the Cybermen design, I think, you know, it makes it its own.
Yeah.
So, yes, it's... it's clearly influenced by the invasion design, but they add their own elements to it. So there's a hint of sort of like a skeletal hand, although it isn't. But with the added bits outside, it sort of it harkens to that. And as you said, the fluid in the handlebars—I don't know what you call them on the side of their head—but it just adds a little element, you know, element which I think is quite nice. So it makes it its own.
Yeah, but it's also identifiable. Like, they don't want to subvert your expectations too much and give, like, Paul McGann a big Mohican or something. I didn't expect that.
No, yeah.
But that's good, yeah. So Charlie and Vol are kind of playing around recklessly with the Cybermat. And then Chev arrives because she was there at the airlock with Grash and she did a runner. And she tells them about what happened, that Grash was caught by the Cybermen, must be dead. And soon after, and to Chev's surprise, Grash just arrives, not dead. And he claims to have killed the two Cybermen. But, you know, something's off, clearly. Like, how did he get away? He's talking like a bit of a robo-man as well.
Yes, yes, he is, yeah.
He's lost his edge. So, yeah, something's definitely up there. The Cybermen give chase to the Doctor and Jansen on board the Star Destroyer, and they run to the airlock to escape. But the Doctor thinks that they've let them escape too easily, because he said, like, you know, this is worrying because they can run faster than we can. But then they manage to get away anyway. So they then confront two Cybermen on board the Vanguard, but Jansen manages to shoot them both with a single shot each, with a sidearm. And shortly after the Cybermen are killed, Grash faints as well. Curious. Did Jansen even use her gun on the Star Destroyer? Why were they running?
Oh, well, the way that I sort of pictured it was that the Cybermen were quite close proximity, so...
True, yeah.
She didn't really have opportunity, you know, to use the gun at that point. So why not run?
Yeah, why not? That makes sense. So Jansen resumes command, and they are able to get the airlock disabled as well. So they disable the airlock mechanism so the Cybermen can't come in. Because if they just disable the outer door, it doesn't function as an airlock anymore, and the Cybermen want to keep them alive so they can convert them.
Mm-hmm.
So Jansen accesses the ship's computer module. This is very Ash and Mother, yeah?
Yes, yeah.
And the others begin to get suspicious. Jansen learns of the Doctor from the computer and his history with the Cybermen as well.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a bit of a hallmark of stories like this, Cybermen stories, where we can get like a bit of a recap of the Doctor's encounters. I mean, does this happen often, or is it mainly just Earthshock, where they kind of recount his encounters with them? I know we did it, it happened in Invasion, and we got like a. They even mentioned Planet 14, which is something that didn't happen on screen, and a few other things.
Yeah, definitely in Earthshock, as you say. Was it in Silver Nemesis as well?
I don't remember that one. I don't know. I don't know if that happened in that.
Nah.
Hmm. But yeah, Jansen now knows the Doctor is a bit of a player in all this. So they all head for the airlock, and lots of Cybermen have been revived at this point, and they are opening the outer airlock. The Doctor jettisons the outer door, preventing them from using the airlock. Have I just went in a circle here? Did I mention this earlier? Oh, no, they disabled the airlock. Now yes, they've jettisoned the actual door, so they physically can't get in, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So Charlie questions what actually happened to Grash. At least someone's paying attention. And the Doctor suspects he was under cyber control. I know you've mentioned this happened in Wheeland Space, and also like Toberman in
Tomb of the Cybermen.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And
the moon base as well.
Right. Oh, yes. So the Doctor accesses the computer and discovers the incident with the Silver Jackal and how this was known about by the military, and perhaps that's why Jansen is here. Is this a little bit like Alien as well? Like in Alien, they had Special Order 957 or whatever it was. I don't know if they had like pre-knowledge of the alien ship and that. But yeah, it's interesting, like Jansen maybe isn't who she claims she is at this point, yeah.
Well, given the fact that she turns out to be an android, spoilers, people, is very Ash. You know, it's very AlienWare. It's all of a sudden just like, you're an android. So yeah, that's definitely another alien influence. Yeah.
Yeah. Chev is attacked, presumably by the Cybermat. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and that's the end of part three. What did you think of part three then? You liked it?
Yeah, it's I don't know what else to say other than that, yeah. I mean, how about you? What did you think?
Well, going through the summary we've just did, it wasn't as
jam-packed as episode two.
Yeah. Episode one was good. It set the scene. It had the locations. Episode two had introducing the characters, it had the mystery, it had the mutiny. And in this, it was just kind of threat and plot kind of building up. So maybe it wasn't as exciting as the previous two, yeah.
Yeah, I agree with that. In fact, to be honest, I was getting a little... at this point in episode three, towards the end of it, I was looking forward to getting to the sort of like the end of the story. I wasn't, that isn't to say that I wasn't enjoying it. I was. The issue that I had at this point is the music. It's very repetitive. It's the same throughout. It's the one bit of sound design in this story that I'm not that keen on. I think that the performances are really good. I think on the whole, the script's quite decent. I think the sound effects is good, but the music is the same throughout, and it has this sort of like constant delayed echo effect on it, which after a while, by the time you're coming into the third episode, starts to irritate a little bit, especially when, because you get these moments where you have these scenes, these relatively long scenes of like a couple of minutes and so on, but then you have very short, quick scenes. And they are bookended by the same music. And so you've just had this long scene with the same type of music in it. It then ends with this music. You then have a brief scene and then with the same sort of music again. So that was the thing that I started to get a little bit irritated with. But other than that, I mean, I was still engaged with it and I still enjoyed it. But... yeah.
Do you think the music worked well as like a one-time only thing, or for certain vibes in the story?
Yeah, I mean it's not bad. It's not bad music.
It says Nick Briggs did the music for this as well. And this is quite early on in that run. They'd only been doing this for what, like a year or two, maybe 2 years nearly by this point.
Yes, that's true. Yeah. So it was still very early days. I think that it had the... It does actually establish the tone and the mood, and it does help with the atmosphere, the locations, and so on. So it's fine. It just needs to be used a lot more sparingly.
So this takes us on to part four, the conclusion. So the Doctor talks with Ike about androids being outlawed, and we get a brief history of the Orion War. And so what was that? So basically, they were androids and they wanted to be treated like people, but people didn't see them like that. And basically the androids were fighting for their rights to be treated the same. And they kind of retreated to the Orion system and gave the humans there an ultimatum. They kind of leave or stay. And that was kind of the end of the war, I guess. I don't know. It sounds like more of like an armistice than like an end of a war, I guess, or something. But that's an interesting one. Well, this element is also very Blade Runner-esque, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, yeah, it is.
But it also comes down to what you would consider to be a life form and how you would respect the life you create and stuff. And Charlie just kind of gets the chance to shine here because in contrast with how, like, Ike is speaking, like oh, they want it to be treated like real people. Imagine it. And Charlie's the kind of, she's representing, like, the humanity of us. So, like, she's, even though she's probably got some quite old-fashioned values, she kind of can see what's going on here and kind of respects the androids, even though she kind of doesn't probably know what they are. But, yeah, it's an interesting debate. Mm-hmm. So, Chev lures Vol away because Chev's under cyber control now, so she lures Vol, and he's attacked by a Cybermat. So the Doctor and Charlie go to speak with the main computer. They actually go to, like, a computer terminal room this time, which is very much like the mother room, I think.
Yes.
Yeah. And he kind of gains access by using a bit of, what would you call it, like a logic problem. He's like, because the computer knows who I am, I'm going to trick it into thinking it can give me access.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it wasn't the kind of, I'm not quite sure what he did, but it kind of worked. And it tells him that Earth Security have set, like, an operative has assumed the identity of D.Va Jensen, who is actually deceased. So that's a big reveal.
Mm.
She's dead. The Star Destroyer originated from the planet Talos as well. So that was in the information.
Yes, yeah, it was.
So that is from the Tomb of the Cybermen, which is a second Doctor story set in the future, where the Cybermen have been, they've kind of retreated at this point. Were the Cybermen at war with Earth or something in Tomb of the Cybermen? Or was it implied that the Cybermen were one of the biggest threats in the universe? Then they kind of vanished.
It's a bit of a, I don't think it's, yes, I think.
I don't know if I'm just filling the gaps with my imagination here. I'm trying to remember what was actually said.
Yeah, no, because it's, they clearly know, the archaeologists clearly know who the Cybermen are. But at that point, it's, you know, it's ancient history. But there is this sense of mankind was at war with them. And it's very much a big thing in Revenge of the Cybermen. Where at that point, you've only got a few Cybermen who are really struggling to survive because there was this massive war and mankind was able to win because they invented the glitter gun. It's sort of hints there. But it's very much spelt out in Revenge of the Cybermen. Oh, and Earthshock as well.
Oh yeah, very much in Earthshock. I was going to say there is actually a spin-off series to this story, kind of, because, you know, Big Finish did, like, the Dalek Empire range.
Oh yes, I've heard of that.
And they also did a range called Cyberman. You'll be happy to know it uses the music from this.
Excellent.
And it kind of spins off a little bit about, like, the cyber wars in Orion and things like that, yeah.
All right, okay.
But I've only listened to the first series of that, but it was when it came out, and must be like 20 years ago now, nearly. So we hear that there is an Operation Sword of Orion, so it gives meaning to the title of the story. But the information is kind of cut off, so we don't quite know what that is yet. But we kind of get the gist that it perhaps is a plan to recruit the Cybermen to fight in the Orion War.
Mm.
Jansen confronts them in the computer room, but then the Cybermen begin to board the Vanguard. So essentially they've wanted to create a secondary airlock. So they've shut off one of the bulkheads inside the ship and they were able to board. with the help of the ones they've got under cyber control, like Cherv and Vol. And where's Grash at this point? Is he on the Vanguard?
No, because I think all the three who were taken over by the Cybermen, they've then gone off to be converted.
Oh, right, yeah. So they rescue Ike just in time from the Cybermen. I thought he was a goner, but no, they got to him in time. And he'd seen something out in space, which was interesting, because earlier on in the story, the Doctor noticed something out in the distance.
Mm-hmm.
Through like a viewing port, and then Ike sees it again. So that's an interesting little plot point. I mean, maybe to be mysterious, it's coming too late in the story because we're halfway through the final episode now. maybe if they'd saw something out in space earlier on, it might have been more of a mystery. So they put on some Atmos suits, hopefully not like the sat-nav ones. And they go for a space walk. While they're out and about, they spot that thing in the distance. So that mystery is revealed pretty quickly. It's an ion storm in the distance, similar to the one that originally crippled the cybership. Cherv, Grash and Vol have been taken to the cybership to be placed inside conversion pods, and Grash is obviously like too stubborn to be converted and resists, so he's deemed like unsuitable for conversion and is terminated.
Well, it's interesting the way that plays out, and actually this what did the Cyberman actually say, that he is
mentally unstable or
yeah, it's something along those lines. I can't remember the exact terminology, and I remember going, oh, it's interesting that
Mentally like distressed or something along those lines. Yeah,
because he's so emotionally distraught, they can't actually convert him, so therefore they just get rid of him.
I did think
that was interesting.
Like, we don't get these failed attempts at conversion often, but we've had them once or twice, like going back to Tomb of the Cybermen, we had Toberman, who helps them at the end, sacrifices himself to seal in the Cybermen in the tomb. We had Yvonne Hartman at Torchwood 1.
Yeah.
She kind of regained her control there.
Bail.
Cyberbrig? No, we'll not mention that.
Oh, gosh.
and Ashad was an interesting one.
Yes, yeah.
Mm. Yeah, but in this case, this Grash was just unsuitable, yeah, because of his emotional state and his mentality as well, I guess. But yeah, probably better for him than being converted.
Yeah, but it's interesting that it's something that the Cybermen can't override, or
yeah,
just we can't deal with this. It won't result in a successful conversion.
Ike and Jansen and the Doctor and Charlie now board the cyber ship because they're doing their spacewalk, and Jansen demands to see the cyber leader. She's got something she wants to say. So the Cybermen have computer records of the Doctor, and they have orders to return the Doctor to Telos for brain analysis. So the Cybermen on Telos didn't know of the Doctor, did they?
Not in Tomb of the Cybermen, but they certainly, because isn't Attack of the Cybermen set on Telos?
Well, we'll not delve much into that tangled web. So Jansen offers an alliance with the Cybermen in exchange for repairing their ship, and like the Doctor puts it, the Cybermen will become the Sword of Orion and fight the androids on behalf of the humans, but they refuse, of course. The Doctor offers another proposal. He mentions that the ion storm will be coming, which will rip the ship apart. So by using power from the TARDIS, he offers to rig up a defense shield And, like, to what extent would the Doctor have done this? Was he just buying time, do you think?
Yeah, you can read it as either or, really.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, so Janssen fires upon the Cybermen and they run away. So the conversation's getting over there. And they just leave Ike behind. So he's taken away to the conversion chambers. Is that the last we ever see of him?
Yes, I think it is. Yeah.
Yeah. So during the escape, Janssen is injured. I mean, I'm still calling her Janssen. Isn't she called like C-3PO or CB-4? You know, something to this point.
Yeah, yeah, something like that, yeah.
So they reach the TARDIS and Janssen reveals that she's an android, like a double agent. And this was a good twist, yeah, because it was already revealed that she was actually a human agent.
Mm-hmm.
So now it's revealed the opposite. She's an android agent posing as a human agent, posing as a human captain.
Huh?
Yeah. So her mission wasn't to recruit the Cybermen after all. It was to collect details of the Cybermen conversion process. So essentially to use prisoners of war as cyber troops. So this is like another dark twist in the plot. It's like the androids seem no better than the humans.
Yeah.
So the Doctor offers to take her home, but only if she erases her memories of the cyber conversion process.
Mm-hmm.
She's like, why should I do that? And how do you know I would? And he says, I'll trust you. So she erases it. Whether she actually did or didn't, I don't think that's really up for question. I'm sure she did, yeah, do you think?
I think so, yeah. I mean, in that moment, because it's just, she just says she's done it. There's no sound effect or whatever. No. You just have to take her word for it. I thought the way that it would be done was it would be left ambiguous, and it'd be up to you, the listener, to determine whether she did or not. I suppose that's still the case, but given the fact that what she does at the end of the story and what she says, I actually think that she did.
Yeah, and like earlier on in the story when Charlie came across as a bit of an android sympathizer from Ike's perspective, I think Janssen made a comment like she was surprised at Charlie's kind of stance on that, like pleasantly surprised, I guess. And in this final discussion with Janssen and the Doctor, when like Janssen's in a position of power here, the Doctor's like, yeah, I think you're capable of anything humans can do. When she's kind of a danger, and the Doctor's kind of comparing her to humans, so I guess also like acknowledging that they are they're also a life form and similar, but he kind of gains her trust there, so it was kind of a nice swift moment. But the Cyber Leader sneaks up and grabs Charlie. He wants a lift on the TARDIS. What kind of goes wrong here? It's like all of a sudden the ship's fallen apart. Was this just the ion storm?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So the Cyber Leader is threatening to dismember Charlie and hitch a lift in the TARDIS. But fortunately, the ship starts to break up. So they all kind of scuffle for their, like, their life support units. And the Doctor kind of loses sight of Charlie. And then we don't really know what's happened. And sometime later, the Doctor wakes up and Charlie's fine. And it turns out Charlie's life support unit was damaged by the Cyber Leader. And Diva Janssen switched it and gave Charlie the life support and mentioned trust as well.
Mm-hmm.
And like seemingly sacrificed herself to save Charlie. So that's kind of the end of that. So any final thoughts on like D.Va? Because the doctor goes aboard the TARDIS and looks for her, like runs a scan. But there's kind of no trace, he says, even though like she could survive out there, not consciously, but you know, someone could kind of retrieve her one day. That's interesting.
Yeah. But she's dead. Unless there's a story I'm not aware of.
There is a story you're not aware of, Liam. There is a story.
Oh, hang on, I hadn't finished yet. There are plenty of big finished stories I'm not aware of. Unless there's a big finished story I'm not aware of where she does come back. If that is the case, I'll be very surprised. But
well, I believe she does. I haven't listened to it, but I think it's one of the brand new, in recent years, Return of Charlie Pollard.
Oh.
Like, yeah. Unless I'm wrong, I think there's a Doctor and Charlie box set set during the early years that came out recently where D.Va returns.
Oh, okay.
I only vaguely am aware of this, so I'm not too sure. I'll have to look into that. But it's not something I've listened to, no. But then we get kind of the final moral of the story, how the Doctor and Charlie are discussing the androids and the Cybermen, how the Cybermen like tried to improve upon themselves, but it, in doing so, became pretty monstrous. Whereas D.Va tried to improve herself with her humanity and became any better.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, which is nice.
That's nice.
Yeah.
Nice. Then they all have a cup of tea. So, yeah.
Yeah, I like that. It's just time to put the kettle on.
Yeah. So, what do you think of that, Liam?
I liked it. I don't really regard it as a particular, you know, particularly as a Cyberman story. That they're there, but they could have easily been, you know, another bunch of robots or something. This was much more character-led and atmospheric, as I said, and I think for the most part it was successful.
Yeah.
So yeah, I liked it. You?
Oh yeah, definitely. As like you say, is more like of a character piece than a Cyberman story. It has its moments with the Cybermen, but it's like reminiscent of what we've already had. And I thought the characters were quite interesting, even though a lot of them were unlikable. But it threw in some interesting dynamics, like frustratingly having like Grash just wanting to execute them. And them not being believed, and then finally they had like D.Va on their side almost, and all the little characters like Ike, he kind of seemed all right, but he was too loyal to Grash. Obviously Vol was quite nice. He kind of warmed to Charlie a bit, especially, you know, when they sent Charlie off to face the Cybermat, and she's kind of like, can you see anything yet, Vol? Like, no, not yet. And Ike's like, shut up, stop talking to her like that. So Vol was quite a nice guy. Chev, I don't think we got to know her that well. I know she was like quite upset about the guy who died, that Kelsey, and it kind of struck a nerve with her. Like the murder, I guess, and Charlie's like, well, you know, if you'd got him to a doctor sooner, he might have survived. And she's like, what? So yeah, Chev, I guess we didn't get to know that well, but I liked all the characters, and D.Va was an interesting one. Yeah, a little bit of growth with Charlie in this one, but Charlie wasn't necessarily like an integral part of the story, would you say?
Yeah, she wasn't really, but nonetheless, it was a nice presence. And even though this is only, I have listened to something like The Chimes of Midnight, so I am aware of her later on down the line, but I haven't listened to an awful lot. And but have very quickly come to like her as a companion.
Yeah. So should we open up the polling station?
Yep.
So each week we do a story. We run at polling station on the website where you can vote for the story as good, average or bad. And you can also leave some feedback too. So yes, of course, we asked, is it good, average or bad? Ready for the results? And do you have any predictions?
I think most people would say it was good.
Yes, 80% good, 20% bad. 20% average, sorry.
Oh.
No bad.
Oh, okay, well, that's good.
I can guess why some people would say average, because we'll get onto that soon. So we'll read out some of the feedback. So Andrew Starr said, this was the story that started me off on my 8th Doctor journey. The story intrigued me, so I bought this whole first season and the next and the next. There were no regrets, no tears, no anxiety. I went forward and loved every minute of this continuing ride.
Nice. That's good.
Nice words there. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, very well written.
Very profound. So Andrew Buckley said, I remember being quite surprised by all the negative reviews I read of this at the time. That's interesting, isn't it? I thought McGann was very Doctorish and the settings were all atmospheric.
Yeah.
I love the Garrison Bazaar, which we revisit many times after this. And I also enjoy the story and its treatment of the Cybermen. That first 8th Doctor season was so exciting to this fan particularly, as it felt like the only performed continuation we would ever have.
Yeah, well, to all intents and purposes, it still is. I mean, yeah, okay, we get, you know, the Night of the Doctor and a brief appearance in Power of the Doctor, but Paul McGann's never really been given a fully fledged televised thing. This is the Big Finish is clearly the closest we get to him.
And I'm sure it'll be the closest we ever get.
Yeah.
You know, time's marching on, and I don't think is there a market for it? I know.
Yes. Yeah.
I know there is, right? Like, and I know, like, you look at Night of the Doctor and it'll have so many millions of views. And as positive Doctor Who comments go, there's always going to be people hammering for the 8th Doctor to return. Would the general public care? I don't know.
You can make some really good stories with the 8th Doctor. And if you market it well, people will be intrigued. People will watch.
Now, I've just finished season 5 of Luther.
Okay.
And Paul McGann was in that first season. Mm-hmm. He returned in season 2. And because he was Luther's wife's partner, you know, like there's this whole dynamic. But after Luther's wife died, Paul McGann's character, Mark, I thought it could go either way. I thought he might leave the show, ending up resenting Luther. Mm-hmm. But then, you know, the first episode of season 2 opens, and they're kind of dealing with the shit they've been through together. They're sat in like a diner and they're just playing chess. I thought, oh my God, is this going to be their relationship going forward? Where they've been through all this stuff, and Paul McGann's going to stick around in the show. Sadly, he was only in for a few episodes in season 2. And finally, they brought him back for the back of season 5. Examples like this, seeing him in like good BBC drama, like, do you think we could get, it would be nice to get in like an 8th Doctor miniseries that was some really intelligent, non-goofy kind of grip and drama.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I don't want... I mean, I would trust Moffat more than I would trust Russell.
But funny enough, because recently there's a couple of stuff that's come out with Doctor Who, including the audition script. All the actors who auditioned for Doctor Who were given this script to perform, and obviously Shudagawa was impressed and was the one who got the role. So this script has come out, and I read it today, and it was written by Russell T. Davis. And to me, it summarizes everything. I think to me it read like bad fan fiction.
Right.
I didn't really like it. I didn't really care for it, and it actually irritated me. It's like I was reading it, and it's like, to me, this is how you wouldn't write the Doctor. To me, this is some fan's misguided idea of what the Doctor is. So anyway, yeah, I would trust Moffat more than Russell. But to be honest, I think it would be really nice, because I think this could easily be done. I mean, if you look at something like, because everyone seems to recognise that now, that there's this appetite for the Whoniverse, and you can have Doctor Who the main series and have these other spin-offs.
I bet this goes nowhere as well, this universe.
Yeah, it's in, yeah, maybe, but we'll see. But it seems to be, people seem to be gearing up with this idea, and we seem to be going down this route. Star Trek and Star Wars have done it. There's no reason why Doctor Who can't, and for it not to be a success. Star Trek has all these different sort of like spin-offs and all the rest of it. And you had...
Same formula, same archetypes that use, yeah. And to some extent, it does work, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Doctor Who could easily do the same thing with Paul McGann. And as you said, Rob, you could have a miniseries, or you could do something like... I'm not saying like for like, because I don't think... From what I can gather... I didn't watch it, I can't really comment, but from what I can gather, it wasn't wholly successful. But you know how you had Picard? How many episodes were in a series? Was it eight?
Yeah, it was about eight to ten, I'm going to say eight though, yeah.
Yeah, you could have three series of eight episodes with Paul McGann as the Doctor.
Yeah, and you know what's interesting about Picard? Like, a lot of people didn't like it, for very legitimate reasons.
Right.
But it broke away from that going off in a Starship formula. You know how like we'll have a new Star Trek show out. It's the same formula as the last. It's a shit a crew going off where no one's gone before. Hmm. But Picard didn't do that. So in that sense, could we get like a serialized one shot kind of drama with the Eighth Doctor? And you know, we've had him. A Big Finish has done this before. We've had him like in the main range later on with Charlie. He is at a stage where he's lost in another universe without the TARDIS. And then they've done that in the more recent years in the series called Stranded, where he's just living in modern day London with his companions, and Tom Baker's there as the curator. Weirdly, Andy from Torchwood's in it as well, but they kind of grounded him and done this kind of standalone thing. But just examples like that, where they don't have to stick to the formula that doesn't always work, or that is mirroring what's already happening in the main show. It would be good to do something like something original. Yeah.
Well, yeah, I completely agree. And actually, what would be interesting with Paul McGann's Doctor, the way it's done, is that you can have it where he's going on these adventures, and then during the course of, say, it is the three series, during the course of these three series, the Time War becomes more and more of a thing. But because the Doctor is trying to avoid it, it's something that is on sort of like on the periphery and slowly starts to encroach on him, And then the third series would lead into what would subsequently become Night of the Doctor.
Yeah. It doesn't necessarily have to try and tie in with the Time Warp part of his life, does it, really?
No,
it could
true. Still be,
it could do like a standalone story, like Children of Earth, something more grounded, but it's a serialized thing over like so many episodes.
Yeah, true. So there's different ways that they could do it, and providing obviously it was done well and it was written well and so on, it could be a success.
And the people in charge are aware of this.
Yeah. And it's a shame because I feel like it's one of those things where there'll come a point when it's too late to do it. And it'd be like one of those things of why didn't we take the opportunity? And it's not like for like comparison, but you know how there was this thing of wouldn't it be nice if we got Nicholas Courtney back into the main series? And they were able to do it with an episode of the Sarah Jane Adventures.
But even before that, like all they would do, they'd use a proxy, like the Poison Sky. Kind of two-parter. The doctor's like, I wish the Brigadier was here. But like, sorry, he's stuck in Peru. Why isn't he there? Why is he a proxy?
Yeah, exactly. And then by the time Nicholas Courtney passes away, I think, and then it's just like, oh, wouldn't it be nice if we actually got him into Doctor? It's like, you had the opportunity.
Yeah.
You silly people.
I think when he does return in Sarah Jane, he does mention that awful business in Peru. we lost him just months before Elizabeth Sladen as well, didn't we?
Mm-hmm.
So close. Yeah. But yeah, that's one of those weird things of missed opportunities. I don't know, like, as a fan writer, if it was me producing the show, like I'd be like, I wouldn't turn up the opportunity to bring back Ian and Susan. Like, whether you think those characters were like effective or not, like, I don't know. It's the kind of thing I would kind of explore.
Yeah, but it's sort of curious as well, really, when you think about it. I mean, for all of Doctor Who in the modern era talking about, you know, how we can be, you know, how it's more emotional and we can have these great character-led moments, you've never had the opportunity, you never thought of having the Doctor reunited with his granddaughter.
Yeah, and having like Ian could have been a character like similar to Wilf.
Mm-hmm.
Almost. I don't know. But just having an older character there that you can kind of warm to that has already had a connection to the show. But Wilf's was done obviously very well over time.
And if you can bring, and I don't mean this in a disparaging way, but if you can bring Bonnie Langford as Mel back into Doctor Who,
without having to give all the backstory and stuff as well, it kind of works, yeah.
Yeah, and you know, you're going down this unit spin-off and we know that she's going to be involved in that, then surely you can bring Paul McGann back and actually give him some actual, you know, visual good Doctor Who adventures for him to do.
Yeah. And I know we got him back in The Power of the Doctor, was it called?
Yes.
And I know everyone was just cheering at that moment where we got them all back. I'm not sure. Maybe we can table that for like a round table discussion.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps someday, like the doctor's coming back and was it effective and could they have been utilized better as well? Because like Paul McGann came back for a scene which was interesting, but could he have been utilized better? But yes, I'm sorry, Andrew, who made this original comment.
No, it's
half
great. Half an hour ago. But you know, he created a discussion. So thanks for that.
Yeah. Kenny Smith, who we actually had on for our storm warning discussion.
Yeah, yes.
He said, I hadn't heard the audio visuals version, the original, at the time of the Big Finish release, so it came with a huge reputation. I loved D.Va and the notion of a Star Destroyer full of dormant Cybermen. It's superb.
Yeah, nice.
Thanks, Kenny.
Yeah, thanks.
I wonder what reputation the story had, like a good or a bad. I'm starting to wonder now because who was it? Andrew earlier on said it had negative reviews at the time.
Okay, yeah.
I'll have to look those up. But yeah, thank you everyone for responding. Make sure to check back on our polling station on the website regularly and vote. Do they only get one vote, Liam?
No, but go into the spirit of thing and just vote once.
Yeah, just vote once. Thanks everyone for giving the feedback, and we'll go to our conclusion now. We've kind of summarised what we thought of the story already, but do you have any extra thoughts, Liam?
No, just as I say, really the only criticism that I have was that point that I made about the music, but that didn't make it unlistenable. I still enjoyed it, and I listened to it, I don't know how you listened to it, Rob, I listened to it episodically, so one episode a day. And I really enjoyed it.
I was going to say, how else do you listen? Like, is it out of order all at once?
Well, I'm smart ass. No, but I meant
I wonder where you were going with that, yeah.
Yeah, no, you know how you could easily, you know, listen to it all at once. But no, I listened to one episode a day, and I was always looking forward to listening to what was going to follow. So yeah. I enjoyed it, and yeah, I think it's good.
Yeah, I actually did do that because when I listened to it a few months ago, it was all in one go. And I thought, if I do that this week, it's going to play hell with my notes that I'm trying to make. So I listened to it one episode a day, and then I was able to like digest it and bookend what happened in that particular episode. And that really helped.
Yeah.
It's better than like hammering your way through them, yeah. If you have the time for that. This is where we rate it good, average, or bad. Will the Cloister Bell toll this week? I'm going to rate it good. Are you just leaving us in suspense?
I've always said it's good.
Oh, I thought you went,
I thought at this point then you were going to play the bell.
All right, yeah, I'll play the bell now. There we go. Sorry, right. We had our wires crossed there. I know you said it was good in your kind of conclusion, but yeah. I thought we had to call it at a certain point. We've been doing this for 5 years. We should be better at this by now. So I don't even know what we're doing next week. What's the plan, Liam? What's happening?
So next week, we're going back to televised Doctor Who. It's a Christopher Eccleston episode. We're going to be reviewing The Unquiet Dead.
Ooh, episode 2. No, episode 3.
3. Yeah.
That's good. Can't wait. Well, thank you everyone for tuning in. If you got this far, we'll see you around the socials. Hopefully we'll be making posts. If you'd like to check in on the website, visit the forum, say hello. You too, Liam. I'll see you there daily.
Yeah.
Check in, say hello. I might just keep on tagging you in the forum till you kind of make an appearance as well.
Yeah,
just
sorry.
Bombard you with emails.
Yeah, well, as you know, Rob, because at the minute I'm sort of like in the middle of a heck of a lot, so.
Yeah, you need to prioritize.
Sorry.
Okay. But yeah, I hope everything's going well at the moment.
Yeah,
good. So great. I'll see you next week for the Unquiet Dead. Visit the polling station, vote, and bye everyone.
Bye everyone.